Hello and welcome to the podcast edition of Ron Kaplan's Baseball Bookshelf, your source for news, reviews, previews, and interviews with authors and artists on books, movies, DVDs, collectibles, pretty much anything to do with the national pastime. If it fits on a bookshelf, it fits here. With Father's Day quickly approaching, I thought I'd concentrate on a couple of books that would be great for Dad, perhaps more so if he's a fan of the Bronx Bombers, but just as appropriate if he's a student of baseball history as well as baseball cards. The first is the New York Times story of the Yankees, 382 articles, profiles, and essays from 1903 to the present, edited by Dave Anderson, our first guest. The book's published by Black Dog and Leventhal. The second book is by Bob Woods, and it's Yankees Greats, 100 Classic Baseball Cards, published by Stewart, Tabori, and Chang. I spoke with both of these gentlemen recently. Here are their stories.
Dave Anderson, welcome to the Baseball Bookshelf.
Good, thank you. Nice to be here.
This new book seems like quite a responsibility, 382 articles from 1903 to the present. What were you looking for when you're making your selections?
Well, I was just looking for the milestones, let's put it that way. The Yankees, the early years of the Yankees, for example, that hardly anybody, not even the most devout Yankee fans, really probably know much about, from 1903 to 1920 when Babe Ruth arrived. But, you know, in those years, only not much happened, but a few things did happen. First of all, development of the Yankee franchise, and actually the birth of the Yankee franchise. So, you know, we had to, it's really a history book in the terms of how the New York Times wrote about it. And, you know, how the franchise was born, how it developed, and it didn't develop well in the sense of, wins and losses in those years, but there were certain things that happened. The managers kept changing. There were some good players. Willie Keeler was a Yankee. Not many people realize that. Frank Home Run Baker was a Yankee. And then, of course, the decision that really made the Yankees, if not making baseball as we know it, was the arrival of Babe Ruth in 1920.
I'm curious.
And, and after that, then everything just more or less flowed. I mean, they get to the World Series. I tried to have at least one piece from each World Series, win or lose. And, you know, the trades, the manager changes, the owner changes, the milestones of the Yankees.
382 pieces. Can you give us a sense of how many pieces the Times has covered the Yankees?
Oh, I wouldn't even think. Thousands.
Now,
I mean, I'm sure there's been, during the baseball season, you had a piece or two every day. Even back in the early 1900s. And in the off season, very often you had a piece. And then since free agency, you've probably had a piece almost every day. In the off season.
Since the span's more than 100 years, how would you say the medium has changed? You know, when it started out, there was no radio, and then there was radio, but there was no television, and then now we're at a point where we have sports coverage 24/7.
That's right. And every 60 seconds, by that matter. In 1903, for example, as you say, the subway didn't even go to the George Washington Bridge. There was no George Washington Bridge to begin with. In those years, when the coverage in the newspaper, that was it. That was the only way anybody could find out, even if they wanted to, what had happened the previous day, much less the previous 10 minutes. So the stories were much more play-by-play, as they should have been. But gradually that changed, and especially to some extent it changed with radio. And then it certainly changed with television, where I mean, I've been doing this for almost 60 years. And you know, when I joined the Brooklyn Eagle, I started covering the Brooklyn Dodgers for the Brooklyn Eagle in 1952, 53, 54. By then, television was taking over, but still, you still had to give the basic elements of what happened in the game. But since then, with all the highlights, with all the instant stuff, not just recently, but from the 60s, 70s, 80s, you know, those years, you had the feeling that by the next morning, when the paper came out, that the people who cared about the Yankees or the Dodgers or the Giants in those years knew who won the game, if not having seen a few of the highlights of the game. So you didn't really have to explain the game or the result of the game as much as you had to explain the key points, the key elements of that game, and what they meant in the overall picture of the season. And that's more and more ever since. I mean, when people leave the ballpark today, they've not only seen the game, but they're aware of what happened. But they still want the explanation of what happened, maybe in the locker room or what really happened in that beanball brawl on the field or whatever. I mean, you have to explain the game, but also you have to, and I think Murray Chass did this better than anybody in his years when he was the Yankee beat writer for the Times. He just didn't cover the game. He covered the team, the franchise, the ball club, whatever you want to call it. He covered everything that was happening in the front office. Now, George Steinbrenner inspired all that coverage, but with his bluster and bravado and everything else, and changing so many managers and firing players, whatever. But Murray Chass taught, I think, journalism, baseball journalism, that you had to cover the team as much as the game itself.
You mentioned Chass going through this book. It almost seems biblical. You have James Dawson and John Drebinger, Begat, Leonard Coppett and Chass and Joseph Durso and George Gressy and you, who begat and turned Jack Curry and Buster Olney and
Robert
Kepner. The early stories didn't carry bylines. Do you know who the first sports writer was?
I have no idea. I mean, not at the Times. I've tried to find out who was the sports editor back, let's say, 100 years ago. And there was nobody at the Times that knew the sports editors. I know there was a sports editor before I got there. I joined the Times in 1966. And at that time, the sports editor was Jim Roach. And before that, I never even knew him or saw him even at, you know, sports social events, shall we say, dinners and things like that. A gentleman named Ray Kelly, and I know he went back. I honestly don't know. I know he went back into the 50s and probably the 40s, but I don't know who preceded him or how many preceded him. And the Times somehow has no record of that, or at least none that I could unearth.
Now, I just want to talk about the process in this book. How did you go about doing your selecting and researching?
Well, we had a gentleman who did the original selection, and you know, and he knew the things to do. And then I got that selection, and I'm guessing. I mean, if there's 382, let's say 380 articles in there, I probably looked at, I'd say, 1,000, if not 1,500. But again, a lot of them, you know, a lot of them were very, very readable and very solid stuff day to day. But in the long run, I mean, you know, this book could have been 2,000 pages.
Sure.
But again, you know, you have to keep it. You just take the most important stuff, what I consider the milestone, whether they be game stories or features or columns or whatever.
Or obituaries. There are a lot of obituaries in there.
And the obituaries. The obituaries are important. They're important at the time, you know, at the times, and always have been, and they're certainly important in this book, because sometimes the obituaries sum up a player or a manager's life much better than any other little piece than, the, you know, trying to put in 20 pieces about somebody. The obituary sums it all up.
I learned
a lot in those obituaries, too, because I had never read them before. They all were printed long before I got there.
I was going to ask, is there anything that you found that really surprised you, that stands out?
Well, something surprised me. The one thing that really surprised me, in 1910, there was a big story about inside baseball. You know, and I just didn't think that they would have had a feature, and I included the whole feature in there. If I've forgotten the exact year, but it was around 1910, and it was a big, you know, solid feature of several hundred words, maybe 1,000 words, and I just thought it deserved to be in the book just for the simple matter of what it represented 100 years ago.
The first piece I looked at, totally at random, which is part of the beauty of this book, you don't have to read it straight through, you can just, you know, pick and choose. There's a Drebinger piece about the 55 World Championship, for the Brooklyn Dodgers' only World Championship.
Right.
Now, the headline for the piece misspells Johnny Padres' name.
Let's put it this way. I've corrected that, and I'm glad you noticed it, because I made that correction, you know, on the proofs, and the correction was never made in the publisher's office.
But that was, the misspelling was in the original?
No.
No.
I think whatever happened, it came out as they were thinking of the San Diego Padres.
Yeah.
You know, who knows what they were thinking. Mm-hmm. But I specifically remembered that correction, because I covered that game, not for the Times. I was at the Journal American at the Times, but that was one of the great, great games in Yankee history, even though the Yankees didn't win it.
And here I thought that you were being true to the original and just leaving it there.
not in that case. I'm true to the original in many cases there.
Now, all-time athletes frequently talk about contemporary players who would have fit in the old days. Can the same be said for the current generation of sports writers, or is the business just too
different? The whole tone of how you write about a baseball game today is completely different.
Uh-huh.
But if all of today's writers had lived 100 years ago, that's the way they would have done it then too. And I'm sure the writers of 100 years ago, or 80 years ago, or 60 years ago, would have adjusted to the way it's done today. It's just that it's a different type of reporting.
When you were first coming on the scene as a rookie writer, was there someone who mentored you, or you were expected to make your own way?
No. Well, let me just give you a little background. I grew up in Brooklyn, and everybody assumes I was a Dodger fan, and I certainly followed the Dodgers. I'm talking now in the 40s. But I was a baseball fan. I mean, I liked the Cardinals as much as I did the Dodgers, because I just loved the way they played. I loved Stan Musial. I liked the Yankees because they always won. I liked DiMaggio. I liked Ted Williams. You know, I was a baseball fan. I wasn't a Dodger fan. And I think that's, you know, I mean, to be a sports writer, that's what you have to have. But you should be. But again, growing up, I mean, you know, everybody thinks when you have been a sports writer that you must have been a frustrated athlete. And sure, I played CYO baseball and basketball and things like that. But, you know, I didn't want to grow up to be Joe DiMaggio. I wanted to grow up to be Red Smith or Jimmy Cannon or Arthur Daly, the great columnists of that era.
Now, are there writers who, again, using a comparison to baseball, you have specialists, you have your sub guy, you have your closer. Are there some writers who are more suited for certain types of writing than others?
I'm sure there are, but you know when you're working for a paper like the Times, you just do what they ask you to do every day. Whether if you're a beat writer, you write like a beat writer. If you're doing features, you write like a feature writer. If you're a columnist, you're a columnist. You know, the thing is, nobody starts out as a columnist. You have to kind of, you know, do the grunt work, so to speak, and then go from there, whether it's baseball or football, basketball, hockey, boxing, whatever, golf.
So when you were a kid growing up, who did you like to read? What sports writers?
Red Smith, just the gentleman I mentioned, Red Smith, Jimmy Cannon, Arthur Daly, Bill Hines, who was having been a copy boy at the New York Sun in 1945 when I was 16 years old. So, and then when I went to Holy Cross, in a sense, I was covering one of the best teams in college basketball in those years. The Holy Cross team that had won the 1947 NCAA, that was my senior year in high school, but then I went to Holy Cross and I had covered Bob Cousy for 3 years, before he went to the Celtics. And Holy Cross had one stretch there, was the number one team in the country for like 3 months one season. So in a way, I was covering the big league team right there.
Is there anyone you particularly enjoy reading these days?
I enjoy everybody because I read everybody, let's put it that way. Not as much as I used to because I don't have to be, I don't have to read everybody every day anymore. So sometimes I take a nap instead of reading everybody.
Well deserved. We've been talking with Dave Anderson, editor of the New York Times Story of the Yankees, 382 articles, profiles, and essays from 1903 to the present, published by Black Dog and Leventhal. Dave, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Ron.
Bob Woods, welcome to the Baseball Bookshelf.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
So your new book here is a nice little great gift book for Father's Day, I'm thinking. Yankee Greats, 100 Classic Baseball Cards. These are strictly limited to Topps cards. Can you tell me why?
Well, this is part of a relationship, I guess, that Topps and Abrams Books entered into, in the past year or two. And Abrams is trying to use parts of the Topps brand. They actually did a book earlier on the old Wacky Packages, which was a non-sports product that they had. And so this is the first in what might be a series of books looking at individual teams and relating them through their great players through the Topps cards that they're featured on.
So they approached you to do this book?
Yes, I've had a long relationship with Topps. Goes back, started sort of instant coincidentally back in the 70s when I was working with a gentleman at a different publishing company who eventually went to work for Topps in the late 80s. And he and I together back in 1990 created Topps Magazine, which was a quarterly magazine right around that time when the card collecting boom just went crazy there. Lots of different sets and different the Upper Deck started back then, and Donruss and Fleer and other companies got into it. And so there were, lots of baseball card shops. And so we created this magazine to sort of take advantage of that and sort of dovetail articles about great players and their baseball cards. And so we continued our relationship. I've done lots of other non-sports things with Topps over the years. And then when they came up with this idea, they gave me a call.
So, and I happen to have several, if not all, of the run for those Tufts magazines, by the way.
Oh, great, great. Yeah, actually, we had a lot of fun doing that magazine. It's, you know, I look back on it now very fondly. You know, I've always been a baseball fan, and it was really a great way for me to bring that into, you know, my professional life. I had just started freelancing about that time. I had worked on magazines in New York for about 15 years prior to that, and really wanted to get into more of sports stuff. And so this was, it was like a great, you know, coming together of those two things. And
one thing that I would like to see, and I guess at this stage would be prohibitively expensive, and I forget exactly when, I'm guessing it was the early 90s when Topps came out with a massive book. It was just pictures of every single card that they had produced for, I'm thinking it was 40 years at that point, or maybe 35.
Yeah, I think it was close to 40. I've got it sitting about... just about I can touch it. Uh-huh. Topps Baseball Cards, it's called.
Right, so that book.
Yeah, that huge thing. And that was actually, you know, Cy Berger,
uh-huh.
who was like the, you know, the godfather of baseball cards at Topps. His daughter compiled that.
Wow.
Maxine is her name, Maxine
That's
Berger.
That's some undertaking.
Yeah, and you know, we've toyed with the idea of trying to do some sort of an update because, you know, it's now, well, 1952 really was, you know, the beginning. I mean, they had that card set back in 51, which was, you know, the blue backs and the red backs, which was really kind of a game. I think there were 52 cards in each one of those sets, and you played a little game with that. But it was 52 that they came out with the, you know, the real seminal set there that launched everything else. And so, you know, this being an anniversary of that, you know, we've talked about maybe doing some sort of a definitive book that not only looks at all the cards, but, you know, there have been a couple of other books that have looked at the history of Topps, but to really kind of get it from the inside.
Mm-hmm. From what I've understood in the past, they're very reticent about releasing that kind of insider information.
Yeah, you know, it's a funny company. You know, it's now owned by Michael Eisner,
mm-hmm.
you know, the Disney, former Disney CEO. And, you know, when it was back, you know, it had been a private company, then it went public, then it went private again, and then public. And they have been, you know, there's always been a sort of a shroud of mystery or something, or protectiveness about a lot of the way things are done there. I mean, there's been some great stories that have come out over the years, but there's also... somewhat of a protective, you know, culture around there, I guess.
Now, in the introduction to this book, you write that your criteria for inclusion was that the player had to have appeared on a Topps card. So that while that does allow for some older players, like you say, Babe Ruth, who did appear on subsequently a historic card of some sort, it does leave out a lot of the players.
Yeah, it was one of the, you know, sort of a little asterisk almost, you know, when you say Yankee greats, you know, because you expect to see, you know, even before Babe Ruth's time, there were several Hall of Famers, and then, you know, the whole group of Murderers Row from 1927, you know, Tony Lazzari and some of those people. You know, we got as many as we could, and, you know, they didn't want to, because it was, you know, it really has Topps, you know, logo right on the cover, and you know, they didn't want to go back to any of the other cards like Gowdy or Bowman, you know, some of the sets that were out before Topps made the scene there in the 50s.
Now, the cards that are selected here, are these totally your decisions? Or in collaboration?
Primarily, you know, what they did is they said, okay, you know, here's the idea. You come up with the list of players, and, you know, we'll review them. And so there was a little bit of back and forth, but it was, you know, largely my decision. And sometimes it had to do with trying to have a nice, diverse showing of the different years of the Topps cards, and sometimes it was based on a player's great year that he had, or maybe a rookie card. But if you wanted to, had a player who was maybe a rookie in the 50s, but really made his mark in the 60s, so we tried to pull a card from the 60s for that player.
And the cards themselves, did you pick the individual cards?
The ones that we were going to use, yes, but then they had done something for their diamond anniversary last year, Topps did, where they had a whole promotion for that, and they set up a website where they had scanned a lot of the cards, and so we used those scans. There were some instances where we had to go back. It was very difficult. It's one of these little production glitches that you run into. Some of the more modern cards where they have foil stamping, very hard to scan those cards. Sometimes it comes out like mud or black, so we had to go back and do some of those.
Now, were you a collector yourself as a child?
I was. I have three older brothers, one in particular who was a big baseball fan, and it was at that era where we did collect the cards and really did keep them in shoe boxes with rubber bands around them and stuck them in the spokes of our bicycle wheels and all those sort of cliches that I really did take part in back then. And there was the trading, but I was always a Yankees fan, so it was when you opened up those packs, it was to look for your favorite Yankees. And I had a kid across the street who was a big Pirates fan, and somebody else up the road who was a big Giants fan, so there was a lot of the trading that went on, but of course we had no idea then what the value was, and a long time ago I had once considered filing a class action suit on the part of baby boomers against the mothers of America, for throwing out our baseball cards, our comic books, our Lionel trains, even the Barbie dolls. You hear about that stuff. But then I figured that their perfect defense was that, if we didn't throw that stuff away, what's left now wouldn't be so valuable.
Now, in looking through these, it's like a mini time capsule, because we're starting with the very, very plain, posed, airbrush designs of the early days through the action photography of these days.
Yeah. Yeah, it's kind of a fun little chronology of baseball and baseball cards, really. And I think it's largely the same. I'm not positive, but beginning back in 1952, and I think it's a practice that still goes on with Topps, when a player signs his contract, his professional contract, and it's not necessarily even when he comes into the majors or anything, but when he signs with the team, someone from Topps is there, and they give him a $5 bill. And that's sort of, cements their relationship, and of course the royalties that the players get from their cards these days is a nice little chunk of change. But
that's more symbolic than anything else.
Yes. And then, the whole ritual of, it's different now. It used to be where every spring training they'd send their little team of photographers around to the different camps and get these guys to pose. You see so many of those funny poses, and sometimes you see palm trees in the background or something like that. And then now, of course, they have lots of action shots and all sorts of different things, but they, still have a team of photographers. I mean, sometimes too, they'll go and buy them from the sports photography agencies and things like that.
Well, that's a whole subculture, sub-collection in itself, of these wacky cards. One of the most famous ones being the Billy Ripken card famous bat handle incident.
Yes. And that was just about the time when I started working with Topps. I think that was like the early 90s or something. And it was funny, I heard an interview the other day with Cal Ripken. And,
right. Wait, wait, don't tell me, show.
Yeah. And they referred to that kind of shows you how far and wide that little prank went.
But it's always surprising when these errors do get through.
Yes. Well, you know, I've got a great little collection of. There were some books that were put out, I think it was in the, well, let's see, they go up to 1988, Surf,
right.
Laundry Detergent, the Surf books.
And it was away at the stadiums of
yeah.
various teams.
Yeah, and, you know, they go year by year with the cards, and they always talk about, you know, somebody like Bob Uecker was famous for, you know, batting the wrong way,
mm-hmm.
or maybe a catcher would, you know, pose as a pitcher. You know, and they always tried to pull little shenanigans like that with the photographers as well.
Because I imagine not all the photographers are, you know, big fans or up on whoever your player is.
Right, yeah.
So
yeah.
It seems like it was a fun project to do, but with so many cards to choose from, did it ever get to a point where you just got tired of it?
No, not at all, you know, because it really was kind of a, you know, a labor of love, you know, where it was challenging in, like you say, choosing the cards. I mean, you know, we had certain confines there, to, you know, because we did separate it decade by decade. And then to encapsulate their career in, you know, whatever it was, 120 words or something like that was a bit of a challenge too, and to try to make it a, you know, a little story that was you know, interesting unto itself.
So just to give our readers a little sense, each player has a page in which the card is reproduced alone on a page, and the facing page is the back of the card with a little capsule bio of the player and also a little bit of trivia about the card or card set itself.
Right, yeah. You know, if there was something particular about that card, or, you know, they wanted to, you know, promote the card collecting overall, you know, not just that one particular card. So we added some little interesting facts you know, peculiar things that happened with that card set.
And we've been talking with Bob Woods, author of Yankee Greats, 100 Classic Baseball Cards, printed by Stuart Taborian Chang. Makes a great Father's Day gift. Bob, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
And that was the Bookshelf Podcast featuring Dave Anderson, editor of the New York Times Story of the Yankees, and Bob Woods, who compiled Yankee Greats, 100 Classic Baseball Cards. That'll do it for this special Father's Day edition. Check back again soon, and I'll be posting my interview with Marty Appel, author of yet another book about the Yankees, Pinstripe Empire, the first definitive history of the ball club in almost 70 years. Remember, we love your comments, questions, and suggestions, so drop us a line at ron@ronkaplan's baseball bookshelf. So long, everybody.